Iran rejects international calls not to attack Israel.
The president is confident that we have the capability available to us to help defend Israel should it come to that. Nobody wants to see it come to that.
Plus, Ukraine continues its unprecedented operation to take the fight to Russian soil.
Within a week, Ukrainian military captured more than 1,000 square kilometers of Russian territory.
And in the search for previous life on Mars, the discovery of water deep below the surface and what it might mean. Today is Tuesday, August 13th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israel remains on high alert for an Iranian retaliatory strike while the U.S. and other allies urge Iran not to follow through on its vow of a severe response to the killing of Hamas official Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, which it blamed on Israel.
We share the same concerns and expectations that our Israeli counterparts have with respect to potential timing here. Could be this week. We're continuing to watch it very, very closely.
The U.S. Navy has deployed warships and a submarine to the Middle East to bolster Israeli defenses. White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. stands ready to help defend Israel if needed.
It is difficult to ascertain at this particular time if there is an attack by Iran and or its proxies, what that could look like. But we have to be prepared for what could be a significant set of attacks.
All of this ahead of renewed Gaza ceasefire talks set to take place on Thursday in efforts to avert further escalation in regional tensions. For a deeper dive into this very tense situation, we are joined by Dr. Matthew Levitt, Senior Fellow and Director of the Reinhard Program of Counterterrorism at the Washington Institute.
Do you think that what the U.S. has been doing in the past week with sending even more military resources is a deterrence, or do you think that there is a very real possibility that the U.S. could get drawn into something here?
I think it is overwhelmingly a deterrent threat and a defensive capability. So as we saw in mid-April when Iran launched rockets and drones at Israel, U.S. Central Command was able to partner with Israel and a couple of European and a couple of Middle Eastern partners and successfully knock down 90-something percent of those projectiles. That's the first order of business in this current deployment. And we've seen the commander of U.S. Central Command in Israel in the lead up to this anticipated Iranian strike. Now, as we did in the days before the Iranian strike in April. The second piece of it is deterrent, to make sure that people fully appreciate just how close the region is right now to a broader conflict, and to signal to people not to do things that would tip the scales in that direction. In particular, I think it's very telling that the Secretary of Defense 2 days ago issued a statement highlighting the various naval assets that the Pentagon has sent to the region, including a particular type of fighter jet, and even more so a particularly capable submarine that can launch missiles that can take out cities. And so there, it's part of the deterrent threat as well. But the bottom line is, because we're all on edge, I think the U.S. military also wants to be prepared in the event that things do really spiral out of control to have the kind of force in the region necessary to be able to contend with that kind of a threat.
Do you think that the efforts to persuade Iran, even though it's saying it absolutely will not refrain just because there will be renewed peace talks this week, do you think that that is still a potential that they could hold off? Or do you feel like it's, as we're hearing, potentially imminent within?
I've said from the get-go in my estimation, the likelihood of Iran not responding at all is zero. How it responds is very much up in the air. I said that when people were saying that there was indications that the Iranians wouldn't respond at all, and at times when people were saying that the Iranians were going to go absolutely haywire. The Iranians clearly do not want to spark a regional war that will draw in Iran. The Iranians traditionally are happy to fight to the last Arab proxy, more recently to the last non-Persian Shia proxy. But they do not want a war to spill over into Iran's borders, especially at a time when the revolutionary leadership is feeling concerned about the stability of the revolution. And so I think that what's likely to happen, and as Iranian officials have recently stated, is that they're going to try and do something that has strong parallelism to what presumably the Israelis did in the targeted killing of Hamas leader Haniyeh in Tehran, which is to say they're going to try and hit something in Israel that is not a civilian target, that is not a massive military target. Iranians have described what happened in Tehran as an intelligence operation, that they would do the same. That also suggests that it might not be in Israel at all. I think it's still likely that there are some number of rockets, but the Iranians have dramatically increased their international external operations, their assassination, abduction, intimidation, surveillance plots around the world. And I think it very likely that one of the ways that they try and respond to this is to try and assassinate a senior Israeli official abroad. I just finished a 3-year project on this, and we just launched this past week an interactive map and timeline of Iran's external operations around the world. And you can see that the two of the kind of largest bars in the bar graph are these operations, not in South America or in Africa or in South Asia, but in North America, and the single largest bar in Europe.
Hmm. So we don't really know where, what, or when, but do you think that the renewed ceasefire talks will actually go anywhere, given that Hamas doesn't feel it needs to be there because they're saying they already agreed to the last one?
Look, on the one hand, the negotiations by their very nature are give and take. And so there is no deal yet. And for Hamas to decide it's not going to show up at the table because it's already agreed to a previous deal, that's not what negotiations are. On the flip side, U.S. officials claim that they were really, really close to a deal based on previous positions. And now the Israelis, Netanyahu in particular, reportedly have added several new things. Look, the negotiations are not yet done. I think they will get done. I do not think that the Haniyeh assassination is going to prove to be a nail in the coffin for these talks, because at the end of the day, the factors that were leading both Hamas in Gaza and the Netanyahu government in Israel to want or need a deal remain. Netanyahu understands that the remaining hostages don't have much time. He also understands and heard very clearly when Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon made very clear that he would not stop firing at Israel until there was a deal, and that the only person who's negotiating that deal is Yahya Sinwar, Hamas leader in Gaza. From Sinwar's perspective, there are two factors that are driving him hard to need a deal. One is the Israelis actually have had very significant recent success in taking out key operational leaders, not just the top people, including Mohammed Daif and Marwan Issa, but the heads of brigades and battalions in the Gaza Strip. And my understanding is that the remaining commanders are pushing Sinwar for a deal, even if that deal never gets past the first phase and only gives them 40-something days of respite in return for releasing some hostages and getting some prisoners released in return. The other factor is that the Israelis, a couple months ago now, took control of the Philadelphia corridor, the border between Gaza and Egypt, and shut down the remaining tunnels, which we'd all been told were non-existent, but clearly were. And it takes some time for the stocks that Hamas had smuggled through of weapons and of cash to run out, but they now have a few weeks ago. And so if you can't replenish your ammunition and your weapons, and you can't smuggle in cash into an economy that is a cash economy that has a real liquidity problem, then you're under a lot of pressure. When Hamas wants to send money to Sinwar in Gaza, it's not sending money through a bank account. It's sending money through a Hawaladar or a money exchanger. There's a cash crunch. There's a weapons and ammunition problem. His own commanders are saying we need this respite. And so those factors that predate the assassinations of Hezbollah's Fuad Shukr and Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh, those continue to exist. And I think that as much as Hamas is angry that Haniyeh was assassinated and displeased with the nature of their situation in Gaza, they understand that they need this. And from his own perspective, so does the Netanyahu government.
Dr. Matthew Levitt, Senior Fellow and Director of the Reinhard Program of Counterterrorism at the Washington Institute. Thank you so much for your perspective. Meanwhile, Russia's President Vladimir Putin discussed the situation in the Middle East with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who was visiting Moscow Tuesday, who plans to travel to Turkey Wednesday for talks with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And the catastrophic humanitarian crisis in Gaza continues to worsen. After more than 10 months of fighting, the Palestinian death toll is nearing 40,000 in Gaza, according to the health ministry there. The crisis is taking the worst toll on children. Lucy Fielder with Reuters has this report.
Like many other children in Gaza, 3-year-old Yasmin Al-Shambari is ravaged by skin disease. There's little chance of relief for her. The 10-month war between Israel and Palestinian militant group Hamas has left Gaza with no clean water, streets running with sewage, and a shortage of aid and medicine. Tiny insects flit around the little girl's face. While piles of garbage rot in the summer heat outside the burnt-out school in which she and her father Ahmed are taking shelter, in Jabalia refugee camp in the north, they're displaced like most people in Gaza.
We really suffer a lot from skin diseases in the school. The schools, first of all, are dilapidated and there's no cleanliness. As you can see, the school is overcrowded and not every child is like the other. Each child is different, even from different areas. For example, my daughter Yasmin is sensitive to diseases. The diseases she has on her face have been there for almost 10 days now.
Ammar al-Masharawi, 2.5 years old, has a fiery rash all over his face and body. His father Ahmed is seeking treatment for him in Kamal Adwan Hospital. They've tried others to no avail.
The reason is the lack of food and medicine, a shortage of everything. We are suffering from everything. There is no medicine or food for the children. These children were recently weaned and they can't find eggs, bananas or anything good to support them. There is no milk, semolina or anything at all. We adults manage somehow, but the children, God help them.
Skin diseases are not the only illnesses stalking children in one of the most densely populated places on Earth. The World Health Organization has sounded the alarm that hepatitis A and polio are spreading among children. It blamed a chronic scarcity of water and trash and sewage in the streets, all compounded by people living crowded into shelters where they have to stand in line for hours to use the toilets. Dr. Wissam Asakani.
The overcrowding of citizens and shelters has also contributed to the rapid spread of skin diseases. Yesterday, we were talking about hepatitis, and today we were talking about contagious skin diseases. Every day there are new diseases spreading among children, such as vitiligo, tinea, psoriasis, and scabies.
That was Lucy Fielder with Reuters reporting. And turning now to Russia's war on Ukraine. Kremlin forces are intensifying attacks in eastern Ukraine as it continues the fight against Kyiv's cross-border incursion. We hear more from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
General Sirsky доповів, що контролюються близько тисячі квадратних.
In his latest evening address, President Volodymyr Zelensky said that the offensive operation in the Kursk region and the liberation of the border from the Russian military is a matter of Ukraine's security. According to Zelensky, the territories which are currently under the control of the Ukrainian armed forces are the territories from where Russian forces conducted the shelling of the Ukrainian Sumy region. The spokesman of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine said that Ukraine is not interested in taking away the territory in the Kursk region of Russia, but wants to protect the lives of Ukrainian people. He confirmed that Russian forces conducted more than 2,000 strikes on the Sumy region from the Kursk region since June 2024 alone. Also, the operation does not allow Russian forces to transfer additional units to the Donetsk region and complicate their logistics. Within a week, Ukrainian military captured more than 1,000 square kilometers of Russian territory. The armed forces of Ukraine are trying to expand their offensive and consolidate their positions. Currently, it is not known how many Ukrainian soldiers are participating in the operation, as well as its goals and timing. Institute for the Study of War reports that Russian President Vladimir Putin is trying to show himself to be competent regarding the situation in the Kursk region and shift the responsibility for the invasion by the Ukrainian forces to other Russian representatives of the government and the military. According to the Telegraph, President Volodymyr Zelensky is putting pressure on Great Britain to allow strikes deep into Russia amid the offensive in the Kursk region. But the British government's position has not yet changed. The Telegraph notes that British government did not give Ukraine permission to use Storm Shadow missiles as part of the Kursk offensive operation. Reportedly, Zelensky instructed the defense ministry officials and diplomats to present a list of necessary actions to obtain permission from the partners to use long-range weapons on the territory of Russia to defend Ukrainian territory. On August 12th, a bipartisan delegation from the USA made an official visit to Kyiv amid Ukrainian Kursk offensive operation. The delegation supported the actions of the defense forces of Ukraine in the Kursk region of Russia and called this operation historic and one that gives hope. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, "What I think about Kursk? Bold, brilliant, beautiful. Keep it up." Meanwhile, the Ukrainian military reports that the situation around Toretsk in the Donetsk region remains difficult. Russian forces continue their assaults and battles are taking place on the outskirts of the city. According to the Ukrainian military, the number of Russian soldiers who surrounded has increased over the past week. The military says that the Ukrainian operation in the Kursk region has not yet been reflected in the hostilities in the Toretsk direction. Instead, the Russian army increased the density of strikes with guided aerial bombs. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London in Washington. The northeastern African nation of Sudan plunged into chaos in April of last year when tensions between the military and a notorious paramilitary group spread across the country, has led to the deaths of thousands of people and pushed many into starvation. The Famine Review Committee recently concluded there is famine in Zamzam refugee camp in North Darfur and warned that other areas in Darfur and elsewhere are at a high risk of famine.
This is no small thing. This is only the third time in some 20 years that this level of acute food insecurity has been declared. It means that children are desperate. It means that inhabitants are desperate. It means that we have an extremely alarming situation on the ground.
UNICEF representative to Sudan Sheldon Yett said the country is experiencing a child protection emergency and stressed that the only way out is a ceasefire. The UN Migration Agency says Sudan's humanitarian crisis is at a catastrophic breaking point amid fighting and devastating flooding. Talks to end Sudan's 16-month war are expected to begin on Wednesday, even as the Sudanese army has all but rejected the invitation. One year ago this month, a massive mob attacked Christians in the Pakistani city of Jaranwala. Crowds of angry Muslims, enraged by reports of alleged blasphemy, burned several churches and homes. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman visits the city as it approaches the anniversary of the violence that shocked the nation.
The bright interior of St. John Catholic Church in Jaranwala's Christian town neighborhood hides signs of a horrifying mob attack. On August 16 last year, Muslim mobs, enraged by reports that local Christians had allegedly desecrated a Quran, went on a rampage. They destroyed about 24 churches and looted and damaged several Christian homes across this densely populated city in Pakistan's Punjab province. St. Paul priest Yaqub Yusuf says the desecration and destruction of the church was a huge tragedy, but the Christian community repaired it in a year. The government provided ceiling and wall panels and fans, etc. to restore the church, but Christians are doing the actual building work now. Sajid Masih's residence across from the church was one of many destroyed that day. A year later, his home is livable again. Thank the Lord, we're in better shape, he says, adding that a lot of the repair work is done, but much still remains. With government funds, supports from Muslim charities, and help from Christians in Pakistan and abroad, the restoration of churches and homes continues, though many are unhappy with the pace. The scale of the violence here was shocking. Condemnation came from the highest offices of the state. Still, Pakistan has witnessed more incidents of mob violence over alleged blasphemy. Peter Jacob is the executive director of the Lahore-based Center for Social Justice. He says when the state has a weak narrative, it emboldens people. And when the state negotiates with those involved in acts of terror and extremism in the name of religion, they become powerful and the state becomes weak. It's like holding everyone hostage. Of the thousands who took part in the violence in Jarawala, only 301 are facing trial. Most are out on bail, police records show. Christian town resident Anoush Anthony says the people involved in the violence and arson returned home to cheers upon release and were welcomed as if they had done something great. Christian Action Committee member Shakil Bhatti says the officials who witnessed assured them of justice, but the situation is very disappointing. In July, an anti-terrorism court sentenced a Christian man to death. Authorities said his social media posts containing blasphemous content fanned the August 16 violence. As the community slowly gets back on its feet, fear persists. Resident Shehnaz Masih says she does not feel safe. There is no mental peace. Even if something happens somewhere else, they get scared, lock their doors, lose sleep. For now, in the streets of Christian town, the epicenter of last year's violence, an uneasy calm remains. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Jarawala, Punjab, Pakistan.
Greece's worst wildfire of the year eased on the outskirts of the capital, Athens, Tuesday, thanks to weaker winds, pausing progress of a destructive blaze that killed one person and torched cars, buildings, fields, and forests. And more than 47,000 people apparently have died in Europe because of scorching temperatures in 2023, with countries in the region's south hit the hardest, according to a new report. Christy Kilburn with Reuters has details.
The Barcelona Institute for Global Health found the death toll would have been 80% higher if it weren't for measures introduced in the past 20 years to help people adapt to rising temperatures, like early warning systems and healthcare improvements. An estimated 60,000 people died from heat in the previous year. The 2023 report sourced death and temperature records from 35 European countries. When adjusting data for the population, Greece, Bulgaria, Italy, and Spain had the highest heat-related mortality rates.
That was Christy Kilburn with Reuters reporting. And in otherworldly news...
Liftoff of the Atlas V, launching the first interplanetary mission from the West Coast. And NASA's InSight, the first outer space robotic explorer to study the interior of Mars.
A study released this week using data from NASA's Mars InSight lander shows evidence of liquid water far below the surface of the fourth planet. The report, advancing the search for life there and showing what might have happened to Mars' ancient oceans. The lander, which has been on the red planet since 2018, measured seismic data over 4 years, examining how quakes shook the ground and determining what materials or substances were beneath the surface. And that ends today's program, but there is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.